Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today on The Point, it's our reporters show. We talk in depth with our CAI news director and reporters about some of the ongoing stories that we're following. Also a chance for you to weigh in. What stories do we cover that mean the most to you and your community? What would you like to hear more of? You can give us a call, 866-999-4626, or send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk with Jeanette Barnes this morning, CAI's general assignment reporter, covering the Cape and Islands. Eve Zokoff, our environment reporter, and Daniel Ackerman, who covers the South Coast. And, of course, Steve Junker, our news director. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
So this is our second of what we anticipate will be a regular monthly show. So remind us why we're doing this.
Well, we talk a lot about the news on the station and the stories we're covering. We do it all over the radio, in the newscasts, and in the Friday news roundup. But this show is really a chance to talk a little bit more about the process of covering the news and how we choose what stories to cover. It's a great big region, and how we go about covering those stories. And plenty gets left out when you're producing these 4.5-minute radio pieces. So this is a chance really to talk about the reporters, about a lot of the stuff that didn't make it into the stories.
Yeah, a little bit, like kind of behind the scenes a little bit.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we definitely want to hear from listeners. Listeners, we sometimes get some good story ideas from listeners.
We get good story. The whole news reporting process is really, there's a collaborative principle built into this, especially for public radio. And we are reporting for the communities that we serve. And so we want our stories to be interesting and useful and informative. So this is a chance to hear from listeners about what you're interested in, what we should be covering, what you like about what you've heard or what you didn't like. So maybe, you know, you've heard a story and you have a specific question about it. You've heard a story in the last month, or you have a story from one of our reporters who's been covering one of these ongoing issues. This is a great chance to call, talk to a reporter.
Biggest challenge to the newsroom for covering our listening area. It's a big area.
Easily the biggest challenge is that it's we can't cover everything. We have so many story ideas and leads, and every day we just don't have the staff to cover those. The region is so rich with stories and important ones, you know, education stories, transportation stories, art stories, energy stories. We should have a whole bureau of reporters, is what I say. But we've got three really industrious, great reporters. This is
sure
a chance
do.
To hear
Very
from
Very lucky. All right, let's get going. Jeanette Barnes, general assignment reporter for the Cape and Islands. Good morning, Jeanette.
Hello, good morning.
So over the years, we have covered the Cape's housing challenges from many different angles. It's a story that continues to evolve. And recently, the pandemic has made the housing situation worse for many year-round residents. Jeanette, this month, you brought us a two-part story looking at the Cape's housing crisis. The first part focused on the problem, the second on possible solutions. In the first part, you had this great example with a bit of news as well that Chatham Hardware is closing. Talk a little bit about how you found that story.
Well, I went to downtown Chatham initially to check out what I had been told about the housing situation in the downtown business district there, which is this idea that it's a place that's considered so appealing and popular, and it has apartments over the stores, that it actually couldn't be built today because of zoning. So that was the genesis of the trip to downtown Chatham. So there I was, and I noticed the sign for Chatham Hardware. And that there's not actually a hardware store in the storefront anymore. It's a clothing store, but the sign is still there. There's an arrow that sort of points you along your way. And I go around the side of the building. There's this very plain doorway. And I went inside and I met the owner, Michael Kalecki. This is one of those sort of shoe leather reporting moments that just worked out perfectly for the story, but unfortunately isn't great for Chatham or for this store. He told me that he's closing probably by the end of the year. And it's because the building's been sold to a real estate investor. And that's really what he sees happening more and more, he says, because more of the younger generation who come in to buy second homes, they can buy for, you know, year round. You know, they buy the house instead of just renting for a few weeks, but they don't live there year round. We have a clip of Michael Kalecki, the owner of Chatham Hardware, talking about that dynamic. Let's listen to that.
They're affluent. They got a lot more money and they got a lot more want, and they got the ability to do it. I see this change. I'm a baby boomer. I see what's going on. And I've got a niece here now from New York. She's 33 years old. She's looking for property here as a second home.
And yeah, with the way the prices shot up during the pandemic, it's only accelerated that. So it was a sad thing for me to discover, but really telling about what's happening with real estate.
Jeanette, one of the things I thought was so interesting about this is, as we talk about the housing crisis, there's so many angles into this story, and we've talked about it so much, and it needs more talking about. But to find a business owner who's kind of represents a lot of small business owners across the Cape and tie the housing crisis to what it means to small businesses and to downtowns, it was such an interesting sort of fresh way to step into this story. And then in the second story in this series, because it's a two-part report, you talk to people across the Cape to get an idea of what some solutions might be to our housing situation. And I know you went out to Provincetown to see a town-owned apartment complex there. What was that like? What's that process like of looking at some of the options for making housing more affordable?
Well, there are a lot of options, and it can be tough to kind of round them up in a story and still keep it interesting. I did go to Provincetown and see Harbor Hill, which the town owns and redeveloped. The great thing there was getting two interviews, and this is kind of the ideal thing for a case like this. I had one with someone who knows the technical side of what the town's doing and why, and then an actual resident of the complex. He's a business owner, and like the man in the first story, he also became kind of a good symbol of what this story is about. In this case, a local working person who might not be able to find a year-round place in Provincetown otherwise. And then a lot of the ideas for ways to change the housing landscape came from a conversation I had with Elisa Magnata of the Housing Assistance Corporation, because she really has a big picture view of this. Let's listen to a little of what she had to say.
People ask me like, well, what's it gonna take to change? What do we have to do? There's three things that I believe, and this is oversimplified, right? But there are three things that we need in order to change housing on the Cape and on the islands. And the first is courage, the second is community, and the third is cash.
And there's more details of what she means by that in the story, but she said that the market is just going to get more and more challenging if the Cape continues on the path it's on.
And of course, if you missed the story and you want to check it out, it's on our website, capeandislands.org. You also recently reported on some really interesting news about Lyme disease. Researchers in Boston are testing a compound that could kill Lyme bacteria in animals and ticks using baits placed out in the wild. Talk about, this is a fascinating story. Talk a little bit about this.
Yes, well, it was a quick story to do, but it was great to talk with Kim Lewis, one of the key researchers there at Northeastern. This story has gotten some attention in science publications, but it hasn't really made it into the general interest media yet, I think possibly because it's early in the process. But it made me think back to a teenage girl I interviewed in Rochester who had chronic Lyme disease back in 2003. And back then, a lot of people didn't know about chronic Lyme, or in some cases didn't believe it existed. And anyway, I posted our story on the Rochester community page on Facebook. And I said, I was thinking back about that interview and that girl from Rochester as this news was coming out. And she replied to the post, which is so great. And she said, she's doing well. She's been off her treatments for 6 years. So that was a great moment for me. And in case, people are wondering if the stories they share with us matter, or if the reporter remembers you like 20 years later, the answer is often we do.
Yes, I know. And this could have such great implications going forward, because it's such a, Lyme disease. It's, there's a few others that we have to work on in addition to the Lyme. But finally, you've been covering the impact of the pandemic across our region. It seems like we're about to enter a new phase yet again, with a vaccine for children 5 and older expected to be approved and shipped any day. Who are you talking to as you cover this, and what are you hearing?
Well, I've talked with 3 local medical practices in our listening area, and also a past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Sally Goza. It seems like most of them are really welcoming the vaccine for children as soon as the FDA and the CDC finish their review. So that could be coming up very shortly. I did speak with a pediatric nurse practitioner on Nantucket who says that she's cautious about new vaccines for children and delays giving them. But doctors I spoke with are saying that the science hasn't been compromised in this federal authorization process. It's really only the regulatory process that gets speeded up for this authorization, the emergency authorization. Dr. Matthew Libby from the Harwich-Port Health Center spoke to me yesterday. He says they'll be offering them at Outer Cape Health Services as soon as they can. And you don't have to be a patient there at Outer Cape. Some pediatricians' offices only give the vaccines to their own patients.
Jeanette, I sometimes think you must have the choices gig around here because your beat covers so many different stories and across the region and represents so much of the region. I think about, you know, stories still on your list. I know we have stories about open space issues and impacts of offshore wind cabling as it comes ashore and education stories, how the schools are coping with the pandemic. You must sometimes feel like a juggler with about 15 balls up in the air.
Well, you learn a lot. And that can be, it can be challenging to sometimes deal with a new topic every day, but it's really, really interesting. It always keeps you on your toes.
And we're happy that we have you on our team, Jeanette. You're listening to The Point. We're talking in depth about regional news and the ways we cover it here at CAI. What stories are we missing? What kind of reporting matters most to you in your community? You can give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking in depth about regional news and the ways we cover it here at CAI with the station's news director, Steve Junker, and reporters. This is also a chance for you to let us know how we're doing, ask questions, or tell us about stories you'd like to see covered. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Next, we're going to talk to CAI's environment reporter, Eve Sokoff. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Mindy.
So let's start with the story you've been covering a lot, the proposed machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod. This month, you actually toured the site with the proposed range is going to be built, if it's built. Mm-hmm. And it was your first chance to speak directly with some of the Guard's key figures and see with your own eyes what the Guard is doing. So how, as a reporter, does that shape the story for you?
Yeah, I think it changed my frame a little bit, how I kind of feel this story a little bit more. I mean, when I'm sifting through the facts and numbers now, I can kind of put myself back on the bus driving around these grounds. And you know, I can hear the voices. I think about the colors I saw, the sounds I heard. Like, in fact, there was this one moment where we were on a decommissioned firing range talking about groundwater cleanup. And all of a sudden, we started hearing gunshots nearby. So this is a little conversation I had with Command Sergeant Major Brendan Bowen.
So who... is it infantry officers that would be fired? Like who?
So right now, I know that's an engineering unit. So those are carpenters, plumbers, and electricians that are firing pistols as part of their weapons.
And they have to get that same training?
Yes.
Every soldier has a requirement to qualify with their weapon.
Yeah, everyone has to. So there's a plumber out there firing his weapon.
I love that. Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
So I think you hear in there, like, this was also an opportunity for me to begin to develop more of a relationship with the staff at Joint Base Cape Cod. They've been a little bit distant, understandably, maybe over the last year. But we want to cover them fairly and we want to cover them in depth. So the more of a relationship there is there, the easier it is to call someone and say, okay, walk us through the latest controversy. Help us get ahead of it. You know, have an ongoing dialogue with us. I think that's the best way we can serve our listeners and serve the Guard and the story.
One of the things I love about that little piece of tape there, which didn't make it into any news feature that we produced, is that it really, we hear you in the field, you know, as a reporter and as just a human being there, like interested in what you're looking at and what's happening around you as you're there. And you're sort of, that's what a reporter does. You're asking questions and that sort of little revelatory moment when, you know, the Guard to us is sort of this unified body. It's this military body, but here it's really made up of individual people. It's made up of electricians and carpenters and plumbers who come on the weekend and train or come at certain times of the year and train. And it's a great moment for us all as listeners to sort of remind ourselves that these are with our community too.
Yeah.
Doing their job. Yeah.
And that's how these stories get told. It's like, you know, you I think that's how the best stories get told, actually. And Jeanette kind of referenced this, but like you're standing somewhere and you're like, hey, what is that? You know, like that is the genesis of so many good stories. And I will say later, I asked them much harder questions.
Yes. Yes.
But no, that's a real moment that you heard in that tape.
It's true. Anyone who's followed our coverage knows that we were asking a lot of tough questions, which kind of brings me to another question for you, which is that we've given a lot of time to this story. And You personally have dedicated a lot of time to it, speaking to dozens of people on both sides of the issue and lots of time spent in the field and looking at documents. Explain for us, why do we give this story so much time, the proposed machine gun range for Joint Base Cape Cod?
Yeah, I think that the stakes here are incredibly high, like just for our local communities. And this touches all the Upper Cape towns, Falmouth, Bourne, Mashpee, Sandwich. When you look at what are going to be the impacts of firing a machine gun range on the sole source aquifer that sits beneath this base and serves all these towns, possibly even farther than the Upper Cape. Really, there's just hot button issues here, right? Like there's land use, water quality and contamination, we said, climate change, carbon emissions. Like this is all these different issues packed into this one little story. And this story is really one that I'm inheriting. I mean, the issues on the base, issues and challenging relationship between the community and the guard is one that is decades old. And to leave it when the community is saying, hold on, we have new questions about one of your projects, it wouldn't be right. So it takes a ton of my time, a ton of my attention, but I think it's worth it. I think we have to for a story like this. It's about accountability.
Let's switch gears and talk about flooding. Mm. You've covered two sides of the story in the last month. You've looked at where we're going to see more of it and how flood insurance rates are changing. Let's start with how much more flooding we're going to see in the coming years and where.
Yeah, well, okay, so let's talk about the risk now before we get into the change, right? So if a major flood happened tomorrow, which it may, he's looking at the weather, in East Sandwich, a quarter of all the roads and a third of all commercial properties could be rendered inoperable or inaccessible. That's the reality. So, in fact, in East Sandwich and Provincetown, those are two in the top 10 most at-risk communities in Massachusetts today. In Massachusetts overall, an estimated 163,000 homes, 13,000 miles of roads, and 2,500 other critical buildings like hospitals, power stations, government buildings, they're all at risk of becoming deluged and inoperable. That is all according to the First Street Foundation. We'll have a report out tomorrow on this, which is kind of fun. This is a first look at a story like this, right? And it's a New York-based nonprofit research group that specializes in flood risk. And what they did in this most recent report is they said, okay, those are the risks today. And then how will risk change in 30 years? Over time, Barnstable and Nantucket County are two of the three most high-risk counties for flooding over the next 30 years. So compared to today, on Nantucket, 5% more homes and 10% more roads could be rendered inaccessible from a major storm in 2050. And Barnstable County, about 6% more residential properties will be at risk in 30 years.
One of the interesting things here is when you look at Nantucket, which has so many old historic buildings, I think I heard once more pre-Civil War buildings than anywhere else in the country, right? Surrounded by water, and that creates quite a challenge for those folks working on historic preservation. Because what can you do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what's interesting about this report to me is that one of the five dimensions of flood risk that they look at is social infrastructure. That's schools, that's museums, that's art studios, historical places that matter. We often talk about roads and homes, and I know I've just done that here when we talk about flood risk, but these other places really do matter too, and it's a really fascinating report. People can actually find out more about their home and their addresses of interest on floodfactor.com.
Okay. And over the next few years, many people are going to see flood insurance rates increase.
Yeah, with that flooding, the federal government is getting hip, right? So, but I should say, first of all, not everyone is going to pay more. About 35% of locals will see their bills decrease. That's kind of Cape and Islands.
Decrease,
wow. Yes. But two-thirds will see that are insured through the National Flood Insurance Program will see increases of $1 to $20 a month. And then roughly 4% of homeowners will see increases of more than $20 a month. Now, the properties that will see the largest increases, those are the ones with the highest value homes, right? Like beachfront, maybe newer construction, million and multi-million dollar homes, though increasingly that's a lot of homes on the Cape. And I will say we actually really want to hear from people. If you're a flood insurance is rates are rising, if it's getting hard for you to pay, please reach out. We really want to hear those stories. This is a good venue to say that. But this is important because this is a moment where policy is catching up to climate reality.
Yeah. these stories can be hard to report because there are a lot of estimates involved. So how do you factor that in?
Yeah, totally. Different warming scenarios mean different levels of threats. Also, you know, changing cityscapes and community demographics might make this tricky. The fact that FEMA is generally considered behind with its science is tricky. But what's hard, I think, is also telling people your home or road is going to be underwater. It doesn't feel good. Now, I will say there are a lot of estimates that are they're within a certain range, right? Like we know we're going to have wetter and more intense storms in the future. The degree of how much that is maybe up for debate. The fact that climate change is happening is not up for debate, but it is. The hope that we have is that we're arming people with information, but it is tricky. Yeah.
Eva, I want to almost take a step back here and ask you, as a reporter, when we sometimes talk about this around the newsroom, that the reporters have to, it's like doing a different term paper every time you take on a story. You're like, all right, I have to immerse myself in so much background here. And but a little bit different than doing a term paper, you can't really just go online and find sources and cobble together a story because it has to be news. We have to advance the story. We have to find out where it's going and try to tell people that. A story like this where there's so many different numbers and moving parts and any of these stories, it's how do you even just manage like getting into a story when somebody says, all right, let's find out about this. Who do you talk to first? I mean, what's some of your process there?
Yeah, that's a good question. It really depends on the story. But I think I feel incredibly lucky that in general on the Cape, we have incredible experts. Like when I needed to learn about flood insurance, the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension has this like terrific flood insurance on Cape Cod expert. So generally what I like to do in some of these stories is bring me to the professor, bring me to the scientist, bring me to the policy expert who really knows this thing. But then also there are times with stories like Jeanette was talking about where you walk down the street and you're like, huh, the story's starting with this person that I ran into. But no, I think generally, you know, you start looking, you start asking around saying in any conversation, you're talking to an expert and you say, okay, who else should I talk to? Who of your colleagues do you really respect? And you just also start over time. I've been doing this job for over two and a half years now, you just start collecting names. Like, I need someone on cyanobacteria. I've got someone for that. I need someone on dolphin rescues. I've got someone for that at this point now.
Yeah, one of the difficult things here is to talk about the tough climate change realities that you're talking about without making people feel discouraged. Like, well, what's the point, right? So talk about how you try to solve that problem.
Yeah, again, it depends on the story. I will say, I think between these sober stories about flooding and flood risk and, you know, heat rising and plants dying, we do cover a lot of solution stories. Like we highlight people in our community, like this one story we did on Jess Georges, who runs the Green Road Refill. It's this mobile zero waste shop where she fills up people's like plastic water bottles with shampoo. So I think the more we can talk about climate change with angles about, look, in your community, there are solutions around this, that I think creates goodwill and an appetite to be able to say, okay, I can stomach a harder story, right?
And hope.
Right, exactly. I think also, though, one thing I have learned over the last 2.5 years is that I am not unsusceptible to feeling discouraged. Like, there are days where it's like, I hate that I have to report on, you know, the number of trees in the Amazon that are no longer functioning as carbon sinks anymore. I think I've learned to embrace that feeling, though, as kind of an asset. I think, and I've had a lot of help doing that. And I actually want to play something. Former CAI host Heather Goldstone told me, it's a thought I tend to come back to.
When we hide from the fact that there's an emotional burden to this knowledge, it blocks us from understanding one of the reasons that it's so hard for most people or many people to come to grips with this knowledge, right? Like we're ignoring the fact that it has, or trying desperately to ignore the fact that it has an emotional impact on us while writing stories and telling stories to the general public and saying, why aren't they getting it? And so I think we prevent ourselves from getting part of that equation. And why isn't society doing more? And why aren't we facing up to this? Well, because it's really hard to face up to. It takes a real reckoning to really face up to where we are right now.
I love this. And I love thinking about my time with Heather and kind of how she imparted wisdom like this all the time, because it's like when you feel the impacts of climate change, not just know them, but feel them with empathy, I think it allows you to better understand how stories will be received. It allows you to be more helpful to the community.
Yeah. You are so engaged in the communities as you're covering them about these issues, and there's so many issues, whether it's, you know, trying to, as the efforts to get people to change over to heat pumps as mm-hmm. opposed to oil-burning furnaces, or like we were talking about flooding here or insurance rates. What's your sense of the community's awareness of climate change or appreciation for the efforts to combat climate change? What kinds of things do you hear as you're talking to people about this conversation?
Yeah, I hear a lot of really well-meaning people. I think people in general, and I think I was surprised by this. There was a point when I was here for about a year, and I wrote a piece about this for the Ground Truth project, where I was running with this group of women, and you know, we would just talk about like dumb TV and good stuff like that. And you know, one day I told them, you know, I'm working on a bunch of climate change stories, and it was incredible to me how they were like, oh, I see how this road in my local neighborhood changes. I'm worried about how I talk to my kids about this. Mm. They're really engaged in climate change in their own lives, and I think that it's a good gut check to me to be like, people care about this and they want to understand how it'll affect their children, how it'll affect their futures, how it'll affect their homes. And I think the more that we can tell stories that arm people with information, encourage them, give them hope, arm them with the facts that they need to have, the more we are serving them. I hope that feedback loop comes across.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point. We're talking in depth about regional news and the ways we cover it at CAI. What stories are we missing? What kind of reporting matters most to you in your community? Give us a call, 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break.
You are listening to The Point. We're talking in depth about regional news and the ways we cover it at CAI with the station's reporters. This is also a chance for you to let us know how we're doing, to ask questions about the stories we're telling, and to tell us about the stories you'd like to see covered. Join our conversation. Give us a call right now, 866-999-4626. Time now to bring on our South Coast reporter, Daniel Ackerman. Hi, Daniel.
Morning, Steve.
Offshore wind, Daniel, has the potential to bring an economic transformation to the South Coast, which is the region you cover. And the industry is kind of like crouched at the starting line, ready to take off on a race. This month, you reported a two-part story looking at this moment, examining the promise of jobs in offshore wind. We spend a lot of time, you and I spend kind of a lot of time talking about this story and how to approach it. And kind of between us, we ended up thinking that we would break it up into two parts. Explain a little bit of the thinking there and what those two parts ended up being.
Yeah, so when I go around the South Coast and sometimes I ask people questions about offshore wind, and sometimes they just bring it up and talk about like, well, you know, should I, you know, get training to go into this industry? Is this really gonna, you know, be a big thing, or is it gonna be just like one of those projects like the old Cape Wind project that kind of fell by the wayside and never ended up getting built? So I think there's a lot of people are thinking about offshore wind on the South Coast, but there are a lot of questions that residents have and that I myself have. And so when I decided to kind of dig into this story, and like you said, we broke it into two parts. And the first part really basically was just looking at what kinds of jobs will actually be available in this offshore wind industry? You know, because we hear about all these big promises. The Biden administration says the offshore wind industry will create 80,000 jobs nationwide in the next decade. A big chunk of that is going to be here in Massachusetts. But, you know, the numbers aren't everything. Not all jobs are created equal when it comes to things like pay and the tenure and, you know, the training and experience that's necessary to do those jobs. So I dug into those questions for part one, just like what will those jobs actually look like here on the South Coast? And then for part two, taking a look at equity, basically who gets to have those jobs. You know, we hear a lot about this massive hiring spree that's right around the corner as these developers start building the state's first offshore wind farms. And there's going to be billions of dollars invested into the industry. And a lot of observers are, you know, kind of looking around at other industries that have sprung up in Massachusetts, like biotech, that have really struggled to build a diverse workforce. And so for the second part of the story, I went around and talked to people in business and in the nonprofit sector and in government who are all working to try to ensure that the, you know, the spoils of this offshore wind industry actually get spread equitably and potentially even reduce the racial wealth gap in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. So once you have sort of some of these questions identified, what's the toughest part about reporting these stories?
Well, the toughest part is, you know, I can't just go out to a wind farm and say, here's what it looks like. Here's the people's right. experience building it. This is, as Steve mentioned at the top, this is a brand new industry in the U.S. So it can be tough to really localize the story. You know, it's hard to say, all right, 80,000 jobs nationwide. Here's what that means for the South Coast. Here's how, you know, that level of employment could, you know, transform a city like New Bedford or Fall River. So my approach was just to talk to experts who had some, you know, likely scenarios here, some experts who could talk about what that could look like. And I think one of the most informative perspectives that I heard was from Chris Olef. She heads a think tank called the Special Initiative on Offshore Wind. And she told me that, you know, looking broadly, the bulk of these jobs in the offshore wind industry are going to come construction phase of the wind farm. So like once a wind farm is built, it'll take fewer than 100 workers just to keep it up and running. But that construction phase at the beginning, that could mean thousands of workers. You know, you got to lay electrical cables under the ocean. You have to assemble and install these massive turbines where like each blade can be longer than the Statue of Liberty. So there are a lot of jobs in construction. But what Chris Olef said is, you know, for a given city like New Bedford, those jobs aren't stable. Here's what she said about that.
You can almost imagine construction jobs like in a boom town. You build the wind farm for 2 or 3 years and then you kind of move on to the next offshore wind farm.
So these construction jobs are really temporary in any one place. And Olef said that if the state can attract some manufacturing, you know, the factories that actually build or that actually, you know, yeah, create these components, that would really be the holy grail. Those that manufacturing sector can maintain a lot of jobs for a long period of time. So, you know, one of my ongoing challenges is really to look into what is Massachusetts doing to kind of incentivize manufacturing, and you know, is it really going to pan out? There's a lot of challenges in getting those factories, both in terms of, you know, policy stuff like tax incentives, and then just down to the nitty gritty, like, you know, the waterfront in Massachusetts is crowded. We don't have that much available port space for these types of things. So a lot to keep in focus here.
All right, let's talk to John, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I suggest you run a story about how more fresh water can be made widely available by taking the salt out of ocean water. 71% of the Earth's surface is ocean, and the depth of the oceans is so great that 98% of this planet is water. I suggest you run a story about how taking the salt out of the ocean water could be made more widely available. What are the problems involved, and how can they be overcome?
John, yes, thank you for that suggestion. Appreciate that. Thank you. Thanks for the call. Barbara is also giving us a call from Oak Bluffs. Hi, Barbara.
Hi there, Mindy and company. This is a great show. I love hearing the reporters talk about their gathering techniques. I'm calling about two topics. One is the housing crisis in the summer in the Vineyard or any other place, you know, like islands with water to temporarily house people, which is to rent a cruise ship. You know, we have these cruise ships coming in here anyway into the harbor with seasonal visitors. And you know, if I was a single person or even a couple with kids and I was here seasonally, you know, you could have a cabin and there'd be shuttles running back and forth constantly. And even if you had a car, you could leave the car, you know, in a big empty lot like at the high school or something, and a shuttle would go to get you to your car. And then when the season's over, the cruise ship, you know, can go away. And I just had this thought watching what happened to the cruise industry during COVID, obviously. So, we need, like, Hertz, you know, rent a yacht, you know, instead of rent a car idea. And then the other thing I'm calling about is the wind farm, because I'm just doing some self-study myself as someone who has grandchildren here and thinking about these new careers coming up. I really recommend that everyone go to YouTube. And if you have one of these wondrous talk into your remote control things, or just go to YouTube and say offshore wind and watch 10 videos of Denmark, Germany, and Great Britain and what the industry is over there, if you want to really see and grok what, you know, has been going on since Cape Wind failed. And it turns out historically it's good that Cape Wind failed, because my last point, so much technological evolution has happened since Cape Wind failed. And I'm sitting here looking at my paperback book, Cape Wind, and, you know, I've read that history, and we all know the history that lived through it. So definitely there will be the construction phase, and then those highly skilled experts, as you will see in this video, in these videos, they move on to the next one, and then you have your what's called O&M, operations and maintenance teams, and that's where the lifelong residential careers will come from. And it, you can see that phase of it also in these videos. Okay.
Yeah, so, Barbara, thank you.
Yacht.
Yeah. She's a creative thinker, Barbara. We like your thinking. And she brings up a good point.
That's my bag.
Yes. Okay.
That is my bag.
Right.
Outside the box. All
thank
right.
Thank you.
Keep
Thanks
going,
for that.
People.
She brings
you.
Up a good point about the changing technology, though, doesn't she?
She brings up a good point about a couple of things. I'm thinking, Barbara, about how Provincetown for a short time actually had a big ship docked out there that somebody wanted to turn into housing for the summer. And it was more complicated than that, because there were a lot of safety concerns. And I also know that on the Outer Cape now they're looking to develop dormitory-style housing for summer workers. So there's a lot of creative thinking going on in the communities that way. But it does make me think that if you were coming here as a summer worker, it would be might be kind of cool to be able to say, yeah, I'm living on a cruise ship
on a
for
cruise
the summer.
Ship, yeah. So, Dan,
and
go ahead.
I actually want to tie together kind of the two points that Barbara made. You know, in thinking about the jobs that are going to be available in this offshore wind industry, there are going to be so many workers during the construction phase that they will actually be housed at sea in basically hotel vessels.
Wow.
You know, a city like Fall River or New Bedford just doesn't have enough, you know, temporary housing to house these workers. So there will be kind of like cruise ships for these workers to live on temporarily.
Oh, that's interesting.
And getting to that O&M phase, the operation maintenance phase, and there definitely is going to be opportunity for highly skilled workers, not as many as in the construction phase, but Massachusetts has really been a leader in starting to train up these workers. Initially, what I'm hearing from some of the wind farm developers is that some of the first workers in this industry who do have that experience from the wind farms in Europe and Asia as well, they're kind of going to come from abroad. But there's local educational institutions like Bristol Community College that are now offering certificate programs and even full degree programs in offshore wind technology to really train up these workers. So Massachusetts is kind of becoming a leader in developing the offshore wind workforce. Mm.
And Daniel, I know that every time you go out to report a story, any reporter kind of trying to find the thing that you don't know, because that's like trying to identify the story. As you were going into this offshore wind job story, what surprised you in the reporting process? What did you find out that you didn't expect to find out?
Yeah, so I think for the second piece of my reporting on offshore wind, that story about equity, I was surprised to learn that there actually is like a really good model in the state for ensuring that, you know, minority-owned contractors don't get shut out of these massive development projects. A lot of people I talked to, both in like the business sector and in the nonprofit advocacy sector, they pointed me towards this example of the Omni Hotel, which is this huge new 1,000-room hotel in the Seaport in Boston. And it was commissioned by the state, by the Massachusetts Port Authority. And when Massport was basically choosing a developer to manage this project, it looked at proposals from, you know, a bunch of different developers, and it scored those proposals on factors like price and feasibility. But fully one quarter of the score was based purely on how good those developers' diversity and inclusion plan was. So the state was basically telling these developers, all right, you know, you cannot win this bid to build this project unless you have a really good plan for, you know, hiring minority-owned planning firms, or, you know, ensuring that there'll be enough women construction workers on the site. And the observers that I talked to said, yeah, that worked in the case of the Omni Hotel in Boston. And, you know, like, for example, I talked to Peter Hurst. He's the president of the Greater New England Minority Supplier Development Council. And he said he wants to see that same kind of model applied to offshore wind, because there's just so much money that's about to start flowing into this industry. And here's what he said about that opportunity there.
If we really are serious about doing something about the racial wealth gap, this is a key opportunity to do more than talk, but to actually make something happen.
Daniel, I think one of the interesting things about that model that you're talking about, which is the state essentially turning back to these contractors or these companies and saying, you be part of the solution here. We're not just going to make quotas for how many people of this or that you have to hire in order to make the equity work for this workforce. If you're going to take on this job, you have to come up with a good solution. And it's encouraging those companies then to think creatively about solutions.
Right, exactly. It's setting up like a competitive dynamic where, as Elizabeth Henry from the Environmental League of Massachusetts, she put it to me as like, you're creating the conditions for these companies to race to the top on this issue of diversity and inclusion. They're not just trying to meet some minimum bar. They really have to compete with each other to see who has the best plan.
So what are you going to be keeping an eye on as the offshore wind jobs story develops?
Yeah, so right now the state has basically commissioned two offshore wind farms, but they're in the process of reviewing proposals for a third offshore wind farm. And I'm keeping a close eye on that because the stakes for the South Coast are really huge here. There's two developers vying to build that third wind farm. One is Mayflower Wind and the other is Vineyard Wind. And by the way, those two developers each will be developing the first two offshore wind farms. But when it comes to the South Coast, if Mayflower Wind wins this bid for the third wind farm, they've promised to use the region as their home base. Like, they are committed to upgrading the port infrastructure in Fall River. That's where they would hire hundreds of workers to assemble and install the wind turbines. They would commission a shipyard in Somerset to build boats for them to use. So basically, if Mayflower Wind wins this bid, money and jobs will start pouring into the Fall River area. But if Vineyard Wind wins that bid to build the next wind farm, basically none of that investment happens. Vineyard Wind would instead said they would go north to Salem as their home base. So I'm keeping an eye out on how that plays out. The Baker administration will decide which of these developers will build the wind farm in December. And so between now and then, I'll be kind of digging deeper into what the stakes are, what this could mean for the South Coast economically.
You have also reported recently about homemade wine, an old Portuguese tradition that still lives on across the South Coast. Fun story. Tell us a little bit about what you learned about this tradition.
Yeah, I had a really good time reporting this. And it actually, the idea for it started as I was, you know, going around for all types of different stories on the South Coast. Even when you get to, you know, kind of the dense urban area in Fall River in New Bedford, there's not much greenery, but you see a lot of these kind of like arbors built over driveways and stuff that have grapes growing on them. And I started asking around about like, hey, what's this about? And, you know, it turns out that this is part of this centuries old tradition where back in Portugal and in the Azores, people would, you know, grow grapes to make their own wine each fall. And here on the South Coast, that tradition continues because the South Coast has the highest concentration of Portuguese Americans anywhere in the U.S. You know, there's been many waves of immigration from Portugal, you know, starting hundreds of years ago. And for this story, I visited Lusso's Auto Body Shop. So this is like an auto detailing shop in the south end of New Bedford. It's owned by John Pinheiro. He's around 80 years old now, but he grew up on the island of Faial. That's in the Azores. And his family had a farm there where they would make wine each fall. And it was really like a family affair. He said everyone would get together and help crush the grapes. There would be food, there would be singing. And this annual winemaking is one of Pinheiro's fondest childhood memories.
Friendship, tradition. And the wine is just a means to get us all together and have a good time. And it helps when you have a superior product. It helps.
All right, you got to taste it, yes. Daniel. What? Tell us.
Yeah, you know, it was tasty. I was there for the winemaking this year, but they at the event, they opened up a bottle of last year's vintage, which was a Zinfandel, and it was quite tasty. It went down smooth. So that clip was one of John Pinheiro's friends, Joe Cordero, who had been making, also from the Azores, who have been making wine with Pinheiro for, I think he said, the last 15 years. So this is kind of a fun tradition that you'll find. You know, it's definitely takes adapting. A lot of people just don't have the room to grow grapes in New Bedford, like they might have on farms in the Azores, but they still do the winemaking and they still get together and eat good food and sing songs.
Yeah. We'll look forward to what other stories you'll uncover for us, Daniel. This is fun. We're happy to have you with us.
It does underscore for me that we're always talking about these big news stories, and that's essential to the mission here, whether it's about the machine gun range or COVID and all of these and offshore wind. But we're also trying to capture the flavor of the region, the character of the region, and looking for these stories. People are still making wine. And Eve did a story about dating and the climate change dating. And there's just so many interesting stories to cover across the region. So it's always balancing kind of the big stories and those stories that touch on the reasons why so many of us live here, you know, the character and the feel of the place.
Stories you won't hear anywhere else.
Yes, and stories you won't hear. That's for sure. That's one of the values of local reporting. We're getting near the end, but I did want to take a few minutes to talk about one other ongoing big story that listeners have probably heard a lot about recently, and just touch on it briefly to explain one of the challenges around the newsroom about reporting some of these stories. And this is about PFAS, which are a class of chemicals of emerging concern, as they say, which really just means it's this class of chemicals that they're discovering more and more about. And they're discovering are in more and more places. They're typically we hear about them contaminating our drinking water supply, and they're called forever chemicals because once they're there, they don't go away. And they're just being discovered across the Cape region in more and more, and nationally in more and more places. For our listeners, we sometimes have this concern that we're always talking about PFAS, and we're always talking about there's a new discovery of PFAS here, there, and there, and that it can be exhausting for listeners and also confusing for listeners. Eve, I know you've talked about this a lot. What's some of the ways that you think about this as we try to parse it out for listeners and make it helpful to hear something that without inundating them with bad news or with a lot of confusing news?
I think that's the trick right there is like, what is the helpful information about this? Because hearing about forever chemicals doesn't inspire like feelings of like great joy. And to be clear, like we are covering stories in Mashpee and Chatham and Hyannis and Nantucket. Like it is really hard to keep this picture straight. But one story that I did recently was go out with researchers who are helping well owners test their wells. And, you know, 15% of people on the Cape have wells, and they're not, there's not the same standards for testing well water for PFAS as there are for the public drinking water supply. So in this story, it was kind of an opportunity to say, yes, we often report on very hard stories when it comes to PFAS. And it's scary to hear, like, I don't know about the quality of my drinking water, about the water that I'm cooking with and bathing my children in. But this was an opportunity to say, okay, let's get the word out that these researchers are trying to find 150 more well owners to help them, and they'll give them their results back and do a study.
Well, I think PFAS is going to be one of those stories we're going to continue
keep an
to
eye
hear
on. That's
a
right.
lot about.
E-news.
I want to remind listeners that we have an e-news. That means we send out an email once a week rounding up all the great, not only the news stories, but also things like Cape Cod Notebook and a local food report, all the great features that come to you on the station. Sign up. Go to the website, capeandislands.org. You'll see a little sign up on the right-hand side. Sign up to get the e-news. We won't bombard you just once a week.
All right, Steve Junker, Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zukoff, and Daniel Ackerman, thank you all. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.